This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of August 4th, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 354 and happy BC Day long weekend. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, a British Columbia Day extravaganza. First, Mario Canseco of Research Co. returns with his latest poll on the BC election campaign. Then, Ellen Mullen, the chief of staff to former BC Speaker Daryl Plekis. Will Mullen run or will he not? And finally, Bruce Hain from Boating BC about staying safe in lakes, rivers, and especially the coastal harbors of BC. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. The headline is BC Conservatives Rise, Governing BC NDP First in British Columbia. Here we are with about 11 weeks to go until Election Day in British Columbia. Will David Eby and the BC NDP stay in power? Will John Rustad and the Conservatives return center-right coalition to power? And what about BC United and what about those Greens? Well, to tell me more about this, to tell you more about this, is Mario Canseco, return guest to the podcast from Research Co. And his latest poll looks at Conservative Party of BC support increasing in the past month. And what does that mean as we get closer and closer to the election? Welcome back, Mario. You did this poll July 23rd to July 25th, 801 adults in British Columbia. What were the key findings?
I think the biggest thing that we learned from the poll is that we're back at the same type of election that we used to have in this century, a very dominant center-left party in the NDP, and now a very dominant center-right party in the BC Conservatives. They're up 5 points since June. The approval rating for David Eby is down, so the attacks that the Conservatives and, to a lesser extent, BC United have been sending to the government are working. And what's really fascinating to me, at least, and will be important to watch in the next few weeks, is what happens with Southern British Columbia. We see the Conservatives dominating in the Fraser Valley and in the north, the NDP holding on to its base of support in the island and in Metro Vancouver. But we have a very close race developing between the two in Southern British Columbia, which is an area where the BC Liberals under Andrew Wilkinson won 12 of the 16 seats in 2020. So how that area of the province goes might actually define the color of the government.
Now, this is a marked change from January, where it looked like the NDP was going to waltz through this election, and perhaps even bigger majority. Everything was looking fine for the NDP in January, but a lot has happened since. We've seen the Conservatives rise. We've seen BC United decline. We've seen talks of a merger between BC United and the Conservatives fall apart. We've seen a migration of several MLAs, several incumbents from Kevin Falcon's party into John Rustad's party. We've seen also some money migrate too. What do you think is the biggest takeaway from your research from this survey versus the previous ones?
Well, I think the main message is the fact that we have a significant change in the way the age demographics are reacting to the political parties. Going back to the 2009 election, for instance, the 18 to 34 demographic was very center-left minded, supporting the NDP under Carol James, and the BC Liberals could count on the support of middle-aged voters and those over the age of 55 to win elections. And this election is definitely different. We see the over 55s solidly supporting the NDP at this stage, not really looking at the Conservatives as a vehicle for change that they want to embrace. And the 18 to 34 demographic more likely to be supportive of the Conservatives. So it's definitely a change that I think is related to housing. There's a sense of desperation from the younger crowd. They're looking into some of the solutions in front of them. And if the Conservatives can connect with housing and ensure that these people are actually going to show up and vote, then the election could be significantly closer. But it's been interesting to watch the emergence of the NDP in a way as the status quo party for the over 55s, people who do not believe that it's time for a change necessarily, and the 18 to 34s who usually are more center-left minded, saying to themselves, I might agree with certain things that the government has been doing, and on an ideological level, I feel more close to the center-left mindset. But I like what the conservatives are saying, and I would support them.
You know, we're also seeing a trend towards men skewing to the right and women skewing to the left. This isn't unique to BC. This seems to be happening in the federal level, seems to be happening in the United States, possibly in the UK. What do you think is behind this?
I think there's a couple of things that could help the government. And one of them is the fact that the campaign is going to happen at the same time as the American campaign. That definitely helped John Horgan in 2020 because we were exposed to all of the craziness of the pandemic management of the Trump administration. And, you know, people reacted well to the way things were going at the time, and they ended up getting 48% of the vote. That plays a role because there's going to be a lot of discussions about gender, particularly when it comes to human rights in the United States and the discussions about access to the changes to the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court ruling that we saw. That is going to put women's issues at the forefront in the United States, and it could be a way for the NDP to talk about what could happen if the conservatives get in. It might be something that helps them, but it's also something that shows that there's a weakness in the sense of the way in which the NDP has been connecting with men. We didn't see these numbers when John Horgan was the premier. He also had a significant lead in his own approval rating over Andrew Wilkinson. And, you know, to have somebody like John Rostad, who we still have 22% of British Columbians who don't know enough about him to tell us if they like him or not, or if they approve of his performance or not, to have him pretty much tied with David Eby when it comes to approval ratings, suggests that there's a weakness in the sense of the way the NDP is trying to connect with the male demographic.
And what can David Eby and the NDP do beyond a lot of photo ops of David Eby going to brew pubs, drinking beer? David Eby, of course, is obviously tall, and he knows how to play basketball. He loves basketball. Do you think we'll see David Eby playing basketball and going for beer during the campaign as a way to try to connect with male voters? Is that what they can try to do? I mean, is there anything else they can do?
Well, I think there's an opportunity to show some contrasts. And, you know, one of the things that we also need to factor in is how much of the support of the conservatives is coming because of the way the Federal Conservative Party has been doing in BC. The numbers that the conservatives are getting federally here are significantly higher than where they were when Stephen Harper was forming governments. So there's a little bit of that sense of, well, I like the conservative brand. I might be upset with the way things are going federally under Trudeau. And this seemed to be like the closest that I have to something like this happening at the BC wide level. And this is where I'm going to send my vote. It all depends on the type of emotional connection that can be established. And one of the things that we also looked into this week is how people who are voting for specific parties are feeling about the process. And the number one emotion that we get is indifference. People aren't really tuned in at this stage. They're not looking at this as an election that is going to be changing things. Whether if you're somebody who's really worried about change and you want to keep David Eby, still indifferent. If you're somebody who wants to see the BC Conservatives elected, still indifferent. And I think establishing that emotional connection is going to be very important, particularly for the opposition. You know, you can have a lot of people saying that they want change in government, but unless you have that vehicle for change, and unless we start to see the numbers for John Rostad climbing as far as his own approval rating, and even be seen as the best option when it comes to who should head the government, then all of these numbers are not going to deliver them to victory.
What are voters most enthusiastic about? What have they told you that they're most enthusiastic about? And for those respondents, what are they least enthusiastic about? Is it an issue? Is it a person? What surprised you on either end of the enthusiasm axis?
Well, usually what you have is people who want change are usually more likely to say that they're enthusiastic about the election, that they see almost like a light at the end of the tunnel. And you know, we don't see the level of animosity towards David Eby at the same level that we've seen in other change elections. I remember in Alberta 2015, for instance, you started to see people who had voted for the PCs for their whole life looking at the NDP as an option because they weren't happy with the way things were going under Jim Prentice. It's too early right now to look at something like this because what we have is a situation where people really haven't established that emotional connection with the leaders themselves. The debates will play a role in this. I think more than anything, the analysis after the debate, the sound bites that are going to be sent through YouTube or to TikTok might actually help out in establishing that type of emotional connection. But at this stage, we're less than 3 months away from the election. The number one emotion is indifference. It's, yeah, okay, maybe we will, maybe we won't. And whoever can establish that emotional connection better with their base is going to be the winner.
And the enthusiasm poll, you also found that people have changed attitudes towards vote by mail.
Yes, this is something that we were curious about because 2020 was a rarity. We had a significant amount of people who chose to vote by mail, very few who actually cast ballots on election day if you compare it with other processes. And when we asked British Columbians how they voted in 2020 and how they plan to vote in 2024, the numbers are very similar to the elections that we've had in the past. Significant majority who say, I'll vote on election day, maybe I'll vote on the advanced voting. But the level of reliance on mail-in vote is now lower than 10% when it was higher than 30% back in 2020. So it changes the narrative of the campaigns. It makes particularly the BC Conservatives, who are fairly new at this, it places a lot of pressure on their get out the vote machine strategy on election day. It's not going to be like 2020 where you were basically making phone calls to ensure that people receive their mail-in ballots. This is going to be more akin to 2017. Can you figure out a way to get those voters who you know are supporting you to the polling stations on election day?
The Green Party and BC United, the former BC Liberals, are there in third and fourth place. The Greens are taking out ads to try to find candidates. My count was this week that their website had 18 people only. Of course, BC United, we talked about their hard times. It got even harder this week. They lost Teresa Watt, their incumbent in Richmond North Centre, which is becoming Richmond Bridgeport. Of course, she's attracted attention over the years for her close ties to the Consulate of the People's Republic of China, and she hasn't said much in the way of supporting those who are seeking better human rights for people in mainland China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. So these two parties, which could be kingmakers or they could be non-issues on October 19th.
The most significant challenge they're facing is having enough candidates. And as you say, the Greens are desperately trying to find people who want to run for them. At this late stage in the game, you would assume that they would have at least half of the candidates appointed, and it's not the case. Part of what makes this more complicated is the housing crisis is so massive that the 18 to 34-year-olds who usually look at the environment as an issue and are more likely to be thinking of voting or even running for a party that is more environmentally friendly are not thinking in the same way. The environment is in single digits as an issue, and that makes it more complicated for people to look at the Greens as an option, either to run under them or to vote for them. The situation with BC United is significantly more complex, and it really boils down to the situation that happened with the merger, the numbers, sorry, with the rebrand. The numbers for Kevin Falcon have been dropping every month. He's at 29% as far as his own approval rating. The criticism might help make people think twice about David Eby, but it's not making people think twice about BC United. And ultimately, this new situation that they're thinking about, where they list themselves as the formerly BC Liberals on the ballots, we still have to wait for the decisions from Elections BC. But it's a very tacit acknowledgement that the rebrand was a mistake, but it's also intellectually dishonest to do this in a way that is sort of backhanded. If they had chosen to do this 6 or 7 months ago, then maybe they would have more incumbents running under their banner.
Mario Canseco, return guest to the podcast from Research Co. The headline on the July 9th story on the Breaker.news was an exclusive in the Breaker.news. It was Mullen run in provincial election. I started the story asking, could Alan Mullen return to the BC legislature as an MLA? The former chief of staff to Darrell Plekis, the speaker from 2017 to 2020, confirmed at the time that he was being courted by more than one party to run in the October 19th provincial election. Mullen and Plekis, you remember, helped expose corruption in the BC legislature, and you can find all that background on thebreaker.news and previous podcast as well. Now, at the time, Alan didn't say which parties, but one of them was not BC United, the former BC Liberals. So joining me on the podcast is Alan Mullen. We'll start off with the big question that you have made a decision about whether you were going to run in the election or not. So what is the decision?
Nice to be here with you as always. My decision is I will not be running in the upcoming provincial election here in BC.
And why is that?
Well, as I talked to you, back in early July, it's not about me. It's not about any party. It's about what's right for British Columbia and what's right for the voters and the taxpayers of this province. And I said back then, if I felt it was the right thing to do, if I could benefit them, if I could benefit, you know, a riding, then I would do it. And I would do it, you know, and then some. It's clear to me at this point that given our current state of affairs in BC politics, there wouldn't be much reason for me to enter it. Do I think I could win? Yes, I do. Under any banner. But it's not about a banner. And that's why I thought this is not the right time. I don't want to win under a banner. I want to win for British Columbians. And not just one, and not just a specific riding. Every British Columbian needs to be represented before a banner, before a party. And I'm reminded, Bob, just recently in the UK election, where the now elected prime minister or the prime minister elect has said his very first thing that he said was, it is people before party. And anybody who says that in this province or this country has my vote, because I think voters are stagnant. Voters are sick of the same old, same old. Voters are saying, look, we are the population. We are the province. So we must come before party. And the party politics is, you know, this notion of party first, it doesn't work for me. I think it doesn't work for most British Columbians. Our voter turnout is down, and every election it goes down and down and down. So I looked at this very closely. I've talked to three parties now about running for them. And I just thought, how can I make the best change? And that's what it's all about. It's about doing the right thing. It's about making change for British Columbians. It's about making change for taxpayers. I don't think I can make that kind of change as part of a party. It's just not going to work. If I was to be elected as an independent, which I believe I could be, you're not going to have a voice. So I think there needs to be a fundamental shift in how we view politics in this province and in this country. And until that shift happens, and I'll work behind the scenes to make that shift happen, but until that shift happens, it wouldn't much matter who I ran for, because in my view and in British Columbians' view, if you talk to the average British Columbian, they're all the same.
Now you're saying no to 2024, but what about beyond 2024?
You know, the funny part is it's a double-edged sword. Every party has come to me, barring the BC United, saying, we would like you, we can, you know, put you up there, you can debate anybody. I mean, I've spent my career in either politics or public safety. You know, I'm able to speak. I've been told, oh, you have the look and you can talk on camera. But then the flip side to that is there has been two of the major parties, being the NDP and the BC Conservatives, who say, you're the greatest, but we're worried you're not, you know, sort of manageable. Well, I just don't know what that means. So for the average voter, that means they're worried you can't be whipped. And in this current party first system, they're looking for, you need to be whipped. You need to put party first. And I will tell every single party in this province and in this country today and moving forward, it will never be party first. Will I put the party somewhere on that? Yes, absolutely. I'll be, you know, with the party, and I will support the party. I'll support the platform. It's British Columbia first. And the average BCer, and I said this back in 2018, 2019, the average British Columbian struggles to put food on their table. And any politician who is currently elected or seeks re-election or election, if you don't put that average British Columbian first, how dare you? And you have no business in elected office. And that's why it was sort of an easy decision at the end of it to say, I'm not going to do this. Because I don't want to be trotted out there, sort of like the dancing monkey that, oh, this guy's anti-corruption and this guy is public safety and this guy is well-spoken. However, when it comes to it in the BC legislature, this guy doesn't have a voice because his voice is the party's voice. No, my voice is the voice of those who elected me. And I will never become an elected official, and nobody should, unless you are going to be the voice of those who elected you, not the voice of the banner that's above your head. That is never going to work for me, and it shouldn't work for any of these politicians, and it shouldn't work for any British Columbian. And I don't think it does work for the average voter.
Which one made the best pitch? Which one made you stop, if any of them made you think twice about it? Did any get to that level?
I would say if I'm being perfectly honest, and I mean that's the goal in politics. If you can't be honest, then you shouldn't be in it. But I could teach a course on that. But I would say if I'm being honest, the NDP and the BC Conservatives made a very good pitch, and I seriously considered it. I think my values probably would align closer, you know, center left. But I think the average British Columbian would lean that way. We're a very left-leaning province, but we're fiscally conservative. We don't want our money wasted. We don't want to be doing this tax and spend thing of the, you know, the NDP of the 1990s. So both of them did. But, you know, when you start adding candidates who I fundamentally disagree with, that would automatically knock it off for me. Anybody has a good, anytime an election comes around, everybody has a good sort of platform, a good speech. I had the opportunity over certainly the time I was at the BC legislature, but I've been in BC politics for, you know, 20 plus years behind the scenes with a number of different parties, and you get to know a lot of the different people. When you add certain candidates to your lineup, as the BC Conservatives did recently, and I'm not afraid to name names, I say, well, that's not a party that I'd be interested in running with. When the NDP is doing things, and I've got a lot of friends on all sides of the aisle, both Conservatives and United and NDP, I'm a big fan of a lot of people. But when you have this arrogance, and that's why I don't like party politics, I wish every single member in that place was an independent, because you would be forced to work together. Not this thing of, I've lost track of the amount of times I've stood at the entrance to the BC legislature, and I've asked members walking in on both sides, what are you voting on today? And you know what the answer was, Bob? I have no idea, but the whip told me to vote yes, or the whip told me to vote no. And that is on both sides of that aisle. It wouldn't much matter if you're in government or in opposition. That's a problem. You are the legislators, whether you're in opposition or in government, and you don't know what you're voting on, but you know how you're voting because the whip told you. The average British Columbian is not served by this system. Not even close. I am not calling out any of the four leaders of the parties. I'm not calling out any specific platform. I'm saying, if these people want to be in politics and want to do what is right for British Columbia, then do what's right for British Columbians. It's as simple as that. And I don't know why we have this conversation sort of every 4 years or sometimes less, where, you know, we do this dance. Do the right thing. Look after British Columbians. If you are responsible, if you're an elected member of the Legislative Assembly for a specific riding, do what your constituents need. And, you know, if you're lucky enough to be promoted to the Executive Council, i.e. you're a minister, then you've got a responsibility to the province. But you must do the right thing, and it must be people first. And I think I heard, the speech from the United Kingdom. I've had conversations with a number of former politicians, a number of former leaders, and actually a number of former premiers. And it became very clear to me, Bob, that now is not the time, because it would be very, very frustrating to me if I went into that place thinking I could do all these great things. And I'm not talking about scandals or that kind of stuff. I mean, that was very different. The reason I went into the legislature for the what's dubbed the spending scandal. But if I went in there and I thought I can make all these changes and I can do wonderful things for British Columbia, and then I was told, no, you got elected, now sit there. That will never work for me, and it should never work for British Columbians. And furthermore, it should never work for politicians in that place. And we've got a lot of great elected officials, let's get that straight, but they got to stand up and say enough is enough here, because there is this shift. 86% of Canadians say they can't stand politicians. Well, there's a reason for that. It's not because they're bad people. It's because they have no connection to actually what's going on with the average British Columbian or the average Canadian. And as long as that will go on, I'm not willing to go in. But you ask me, will I go in? Yes, I will. At some point, I will. But it's got to be at a time when it's not good for me. It's not good for a party. It's not good for the media. It's not because I look good or I can talk good. It's because I can do good. It's because I can make a difference for this province.
Who was that candidate that the Conservatives welcomed in that helped make your decision easier?
I'm not, particularly impressed with sort of any specific candidate on any side, but it made my decision a lot easier to say, sort of, I'm definitely not going Conservative when they welcomed in Theresa Watt. And it's nothing, specifically personal against her or against the former BC Liberals, now the BC United, or the BC Conservatives. You've done a lot of stories, Bob. The mainstream media have done a lot of stories. And anybody who knows Theresa Watt or what she's done, in her political career, I just thought there is zero chance that I am interested in any way, shape, or form being affiliated or associated to her or a party that she's associated with. I'm reminded, and this is a campaign I worked on, Glenn Clark's campaign. She was with the NDP back then. Then she became BC Liberal. Then she became BC United, now BC Conservative. So, it's basically, in my view, like throwing darts at a dartboard. I guess it's political opportunism. I'm not particularly impressed with Eleanor Circle jumping ship. If somebody had asked me to predict which way she would jump, well, if you're going to jump anywhere, I mean, the obvious choice for her would have been the NDP. But again, in my view, it's this political opportunism of, I'm just looking for a job and I'm looking for my pension. That is never going to work for me. And I'll remind your listeners, Bob, that if anybody wants to know about the kind of things that I'm referencing that I would have a serious, serious, fundamental issue with Theresa Watt, I would reference your previous articles and the Breaker.News previous articles and podcasts over the years about Theresa Watt and her connections and where a lot of the old BC Liberal money came from. That is just not something I'm into. It's funny that the BC Conservatives and the BC NDP want to trot me out there as Mr. Anti-Corruption. Oh, vote for us, we're anti-corruption. But yet you expect me to run along somebody like that. It will never happen. It just will never happen. Because at the end of the day, I don't need to run for politics. I don't need to, run after a pension or the limelight or the media attention. But I do need to sleep at night. And I need to look at myself in the mirror in the morning when I shave. And if I did that, as soon as that move was made, I thought, well, BC Conservatives are off the table. And I sent a note literally 2 minutes after it was announced to the executive director saying, not a chance. And in short order, I sent a number of notes to the BC NDP saying, I'm done. Will I support a party coming up to the election? Maybe, if I can be helpful in some way, but not helpful to the party, but helpful to the constituents, helpful to our riding, helpful to British Columbians, then I will do so. But politics needs to change, and the tide is changing. We are a parliamentary system, and all we have to do is look where the parliamentary system came from, the United Kingdom. The Prime Minister stood up and said, "It's over. This thing of what we've been doing, it's over." And after 18 years, Labour is in, and the Prime Minister said, "People first and party a distant second." And that's what it should be.
Alan Mullen, you listed all those parties that Theresa Watt has been involved with over the years. And of course, as a journalist, and I know other journalists have asked the same question about her proximity to the Chinese Communist Party and willing to engage with people who support the Chinese Communist Party, willing to engage with the Consul General here in Vancouver, especially at a time when Canada-China relations are at a low point. And when people, so many people in Canada, so many people in British Columbia who've moved here from places like Hong Kong, mainland China, people that move here from Taiwan, people that are concerned about the future of the Asia Pacific and China under Xi Jinping interfering in Canada. Invitation to Theresa Watt to come on this podcast to answer my questions about her history and politics here in British Columbia and her relations with the Chinese government and its supporters. My invitation is open. If she wants to contact me, she can come here on this podcast, the Breaker.News podcast, just like Alan Mullen did. Alan Mullen, the former chief of staff to Darrell Plekis, speaker of the legislature from 2017 to 2020, and also staying out of politics for now and remaining as an investigator with a provincial regulatory body.
Pleasure as always, Bob. Thank you.
Bruce Hain, the executive director of Boating BC, the BC Boating Association, on BC Day weekend, this BC Day weekend edition of the podcast. More people are using the water than ever before, from stand-up paddleboards to super yachts and everything in between. Boating safety is a big issue around Metro Vancouver. It's one of North America's busiest harbors for commerce. It's also an airport for seaplanes. And we saw what happened June 8th. There was a collision in Cole Harbour between a harbor airplane and a pleasure craft. Luckily, no one was killed, but there are concerns about the use of water and by whom and whether people are qualified to use the water. Bruce, what are your concerns?
Well, thanks, Bob. Thanks for having me on the podcast. There certainly are increased hazards when recreational boaters and commercial vessels are sharing the same waterways. It's quite a bit different in a typical lake environment, in a freshwater environment that many boaters are very familiar with. Getting out and doing some fishing or just cruising or recreating, you know, dragging their kids and grandkids around in tubes and that type of thing, where there's typically only recreational vessels on the water. But when you get into an environment like in and around Cole Harbour, the Port of Vancouver, Port of Victoria, Port of Nanaimo, anywhere up and down the south coast, there's the added hazards or potential hazards of interacting with large commercial vessels, and they have their own unique challenges with sight lines or how quickly they can stop or maneuver and those types of things. And so recreational boaters, first and foremost, have to be aware of the rules out there and just exercise additional caution when they're in those kind of waterways.
Is there legislation that can be put into place? Should there be mandatory licensing for people who get behind the wheel in a boat?
Well, there is. So a PCOC, the pleasure craft operator card, is required if you're operating a vessel that you own or borrowing. That same rule does not apply in boat rentals. And so that is an issue that's been discussed repeatedly at National Transport Canada meetings that we and other stakeholders attend both regionally and nationally. It really, first and foremost, it comes down to education. The rules of the sea, if you will, the rules on the water are being constantly sort of monitored and updated where necessary. But really, it comes down to being prepared and having common sense when you're out there. Unlike driving on our roads, where there are very clearly defined lanes and traffic patterns and things like that, you don't get that same sense when you're out in the water. There are rules of the water and who has the right of way and things like that, but you don't know that everybody either knows them or is going to adhere to them. So again, first and foremost, it's getting educated, understanding what those rules are, and then being prepared and having the proper safety equipment on board. With that incident with the yacht, apparently there were not enough life jackets on board for everybody that was there. So, and that is absolutely the law. So, you know, people that choose to ignore the law or are not aware of it, do so at their own risk.
Should there be extra legislation to mandate English language proficiency on the water? Because English is the language that's used for dispatch radio, for marine emergency radio. Should there be mandatory swimming knowledge, for instance, mandatory swimming certifications, and also mandatory life jackets? Not everyone uses life jackets when they're out boating. Those are self-evident. People shouldn't need to be legislated to do those things, but should there be more legislation, more compliance and enforcement?
Well, in some of those cases that you cite, I believe that there is more legislation coming, and it's probably coming quite relatively quickly for mandatory life jacket wear. It's been a point of discussion for quite a few years with user groups in Transport Canada, the Canadian Safe Boating Council, Canadian Life Saving Society. My counterparts across Canada, we've all been discussing mandatory wear, and what we're asking for is some really good data to support the size of vessel that would require mandatory wear, and the ages and the type of vessel that it is that would support mandatory wear, and so on. So so that we have that data and we have that information at our fingertips to be able to make those informed decisions. And unfortunately, a lot of that data has not been collected in the same degree that, this, for instance, the U.S. Coast Guard collects that data for boat collisions and boat fatalities on an annual basis.
July 31st was the Transportation Safety Board report. The headline on it was TSB concerned about Canada's marine emergency preparedness following investigation into a fire aboard container vessel Zim Kingston. What are your initial thoughts on that?
I think that's a very fair comment, and Canada has arguably some of the most kilometers of coastline in the world for a country. I think it may be the number one or number two behind Russia, but we need to be continuing to invest in Coast Guard. We need to continually invest in other agencies like RCM SAR. You mentioned them earlier, the Royal Canadian Marine Search and Rescue, which do get funding from Coast Guard through Transport Canada to have vessels ready with highly trained volunteers to act very quickly in a case of emergency, but we need more of that. We need the federal government to be investing in the Canadian Coast Guard and these other agencies to make sure that we do have the kind of network of response vessels and qualified volunteers to be able to get out there and help when an emergency happens.
Provincially, there's the election coming up October 19th. What do voters want from the politicians and from government?
Well, certainly a vast majority of regulations, particularly in coastal waters, are federal jurisdiction through Transport Canada or the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, DFO. But the province does have a lot of regulatory powers, as do municipalities, in fact, with their waterways. One of the things that the provincial government has been looking at is amendments to the Land Act to be able to co-manage Crown lands, and that includes waterlot leases. with local indigenous communities. And what our industry is hoping for is a lot more consultation and a lot more clarity around those issues. Currently, it takes 3 to 5 years to get a water lot lease renewed for a marina, as an example. These water lot leases are 30 years or a 30-year tenure. And the huge cost of infrastructure development now for breakwaters and dock systems and fuel tanks and those types of things are increasingly expensive. And funding lenders, the banks are saying that a 30-year lease is simply not is not workable for the return on investment. So what we're looking for is longer term leases, 60-year leases, that would give operators that length of time to be able to make those infrastructure investments in things like breakwaters as climate change is creating more storm surges and storm events. The marinas have to be investing in that infrastructure for climate change adaptation and mitigation. And they simply can't do that on a 30-year timeline. So those are the types of things that we're looking for from the provincial government.
And then finally, on a lighter political question, you used to be on Surrey City Council. You ran for mayor in 2018. You're now running the BC Boating Industries Association. Do you miss politics at all, especially since you can get out in the water and get away from it all every once in a while?
You know what? There are some aspects of politics that that I do miss, and it gave me opportunities to do things that I might never have been able to do as a private citizen, being able to attend certain conferences and speak at conferences that I wouldn't have had the opportunity to. On the other hand, as you well know, and your viewers and listeners well know, things are never dull in Surrey or in BC politics for that matter. And for that reason, I don't miss it, and I enjoy exactly what I'm doing.
Safe boating for you and everyone else.
Thanks very much, Bob. And I would just encourage people to get out in the water, because we have some of the best waterways in the entire world. But please be safe out there.
Bruce Hain, the Executive Director of Boating BC, the BC Boating Association.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In the Taiwan news, Taiwan joins Inter-Parliamentary Alliance on China. Taiwan joined the coalition with legislators from the Democratic Progressive Party and Taiwan People's Party as co-chairs. Before the IPAC meeting began, the Kuomintang said it would not send official representatives to the summit, but its legislators were free to attend if they wished. President Lai Ching-te told the conference that a threat from China to any country is a threat to the world. According to the presidential office, Lai said the IPAC delegation represented the largest meeting of foreign lawmakers ever in Taiwan, with lawmakers from 29 countries and the European Parliament. In the Kyoto news, Nagasaki mayor says Israel not invited to a bomb peace ceremony. Mayor Shiro Suzuki said in June that he had sent a letter to Israel calling for a ceasefire in the conflict in the Gaza Strip, while leaving an invitation to the August 9th ceremony on hold due to the risk of, quote, unexpected situations, end quote, such as protests amid international condemnation of the country's war conduct. Hiroshima, for its part, has invited Israel to its August 6th ceremony, marking the 79th anniversary of the A-bomb attack, with a message calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. In Hong Kong Free Press, China's factory activity contracts for a third month as Beijing vows more state support to boost economy. A key measure of factory output, the Manufacturing Purchasers Managers Index, stood at 49.4 in July, down slightly from 49.5 in June, the National Bureau of Statistics announced.
That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, the owner of a beloved North Portland newspaper is behind bars in Alabama on charges of making rape threats. The bizarre saga has left the 120-year-old North Portland newspaper's future uncertain. The owner of the St. John's Review, Richard Colvin, is behind bars in Alabama. A federal agent says he made the threats against the elderly female receptionist of a Methodist church in Mobile. In Crosscut, remembering Charlie Royer, Seattle's only three-term mayor. Helping the city reinvent itself after the Boeing bust, Royer pushed for a Westlake Park makeover, the convention center, and low-income housing. Royer, who was a King 5 TV reporter before politics, died at age 84 on July 26th. Also in Crosscut, lawsuit filed against Washington Attorney General's office for withholding public records. And in the Breaker.News, read stories such as Summertime Blues at ICBC due to licensing backlog, and Watt flees sinking BC United ship. Conservative leader Rustad says he met with CSIS. Read the stories behind the headlines in the Breaker.News.
That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar. Brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to
British Columbians, all 5.6 million of you, and all of those who contributed to the commerce, the culture, the sports, the environment of Canada's Pacific Province since 1871. As it says on the coat of arms, splendor without diminishment. Happy British Columbia Day weekend.
You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of August 4th, 2024, the special BC Day weekend edition. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 4th of August in 1889, the Great Fire of Spokane in Washington State, 32 city blocks were destroyed. Seattle and Ellensburg also suffered from major fires in 1889, 3 years after the Great Vancouver Fire of 1886. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Bookmark thebreaker.news and sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News as news happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews.
Until next week.